Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It is the equivalent of Tour Live, but you will have noticed that it is not live. It is, instead, this week, us doing our last little rundown of books and bits and bobs that have interested us in the run-up to Christmas. We always like doing this, really, John. It's odd that you don't normally get to give it a whole show. It often becomes sort of little sort of segments going all the way through. But obviously, with Liverpool not playing, we've taken the opportunity to do two of these now where we're speaking to people we like who've written books we like.
Yeah, and a nice variety as well, you know, from stuff around football history to what Keogh's done, which is, you know, a kid's book aimed at teaching them Liverpool songs. So something for everyone. You might get some ideas for stocking fillers or Christmas presents, Secret Santas, that sort of thing, if you have a little bit of a look. But as you say, then there's nice people and there's nice chats. So if you're never going to buy a book ever again in your life, I'm sure you'll still enjoy it.
Indeed, that is the spirit. Other than actually buy books.
No, do buy books. Yeah. It would be a strange position to take, though.
Yeah, not just these ones either, you know what I mean? There's a lot of books out there. Join a library, etc., etc. Books are mostly good. They're not all good books, don't get me wrong, but they are mostly but good. So coming up, you've got Dan Gray talking to John. If you subscribe, you'll have a longer chat with me, Dan, and John, which was a pleasure to do. And Dan's always just the very, of all the people I've never met in person, he is the finest company I've ever known. The wonderful Ian Plenderleith in there as well. We've got Kieran Molyneux, Daniel Gee, and Tony Evans talking about his new fictional work as well. So everything in there, different flavours, different types as we go all the way through this one. So this is Filling In for Tour Live this week. From next Friday, normal service will be resumed. In general, if you haven't done so yet, do check out John's interview with Christian Falk about Jude Bellingham, which was the talk of the town this week. He got us put in brackets on certain accounts. That's how you know shit's got very, very real indeed when you're getting bracketed on accounts. It was good to see that sort of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It caused quite a stir, yep. I would say, in the internet.
Yep. Brackets, John Gibbons' blog, and a whole new community trying to work out what the blog is.
It was a market research blog.
Yeah.
There we are. People don't believe me.
Yeah,
it was a Twitter account set up to promote my market research blog.
How's the blog going, John? That's the and other stuff from the week as well. Obviously, there's the Klopp stuff supported by Dinger as ever. A big thank you to them. Do tell everyone you've ever met about the Klopp thing. That would be great. It would be fabulous if you can take the opportunity to do that and make a big difference to us. Other little bits and pieces as well. Obviously, we went to see Liverpool Women last weekend. Both me and John went to see Liverpool Women last weekend. This weekend, they are playing a massive game against Leicester City, and they've gone through, if reports are to be believed, in the Conti Cup. It's still a matter of there appears to be so much.
Calculations are ongoing, but it's looking good.
Yeah, I'm back in Philippa. Philippa wouldn't be wrong about this.
It's a recount in Luton.
absolutely. It's gone later than we expected and uneaten. That is in there as well. So that'll be great this weekend. And then from next week, it's the beginning of getting back to what can be called something pretty approaching normal service. There's obviously the next instalment of Jürgen, which is being exported as we speak. I've learned a lot about exports across the last 2.5 weeks or so.
Take fucking ages.
It appears to be an arduous process. It really does. People are like planning meals around them.
Oh, yeah.
That's the bit that's most sort of shocked me, to be honest with you. Exports are quite something there in there as well. And then Tour Live next week will obviously be influenced by the fact that there's the game against AC Milan. And then we're not too far away from the game against Manchester City. We've got a full Christmas programme lined up for you on the Anfield app. So download the app, subscribe, take the time to do that if you can. Not just for all the wonderful stuff that will be coming up on Jürgen, but for what should be a pretty good second half of the season, we're very much excited and are very much getting back into it. But until then, here is some combination of me and John speaking to some combination of Dan, Ian, Keo, Dan and Tony.
It's John Gibbons for Tour Live with an old friend, Daniel Gray, friend of the show. Everybody knows him on all the time. Can't get rid of him, etc. From here all my life. Dan, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on again, John. I'm hyped because I had Weetabix with Cocoa Pops on top of them, scattered over them this morning. Just living La Vida.
That feels like somebody like you when you were 11 and your mum says to you, do you want Weetabix or Cocoa Pops? And you're like, both. And she's like, don't be stupid, Daniel. And you're like, when I'm a grown up, I'm going to have both every morning.
I've done it. No, I've left home. It's like having a variety pack, sunshine indoors.
Just don't tell the wife. absolutely brilliant. We're here to talk about your book, Silence of the Stands, your latest book. I wouldn't quite describe you as prolific, Dan, but you've certainly got a range of well-selling books now, and this is the latest, Silence of the Stands, and it's all about the return of football and, you know, our relationship with it and how we reevaluated that during lockdown and particularly when football stopped and also when football carried on but we weren't allowed in, and then finally when we were allowed to go and watch any or every type of football we could.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, millions of us felt the same, and we knew it wasn't even in the worst 100 things about COVID football going, but at the same time I felt our feelings of missing it were valid, and missing our routine, all of those rituals around it, the sense of belonging, missing the grounds, our second homes, really. I think we just, whether it's Anfield or wherever you go and watch your football, or if you travel around, just not having those Saturday berths, those fixtures, literally those fixtures in the calendar written down. I thought it was worth recording what that felt like. May we never have to go through it again, because it was so different to a pre-season when you know you've got the staging post and football's going to come back in August. And so from the time of missing it, I was making notes and writing little bits and bobs about the feeling of it all. And, you know, breaking down in tears when you heard the music on Five Live, things like that at lunchtime, just ridiculously emotional time. And then just vowing to get back to any game that was allowed, which was the first one I went back to, was Jarrow in the Northern League in September. And then restrictions changed a lot, which dictated a lot of what I did, but a lot in the Northwest as a result of that. I was at Southport, Workington, Kendal, Lancaster. So a lot down that side of the country, different levels, some behind closed door stuff, because I thought that was worth recording as well, what exactly it was like hearing the players shout so much and all of the rest of that. So it was a completely remarkable thing. And as the subtitle is, Finding the Joy in the Season, I did see some things that really rejuvenated me, and the resilience of the game and the people, the volunteers especially, that run the game, that did anything and everything to get the games on, from, you know, the 2 meter distance T bar queues and all of the rest of that. So I suppose, being writing history as well, I really wanted to record this remarkable time and through the way I know best, which is traveling to odd places.
Yeah, I mean, you do that fantastically well. I mean, I was reading the book, and you do forget the things that we had to do to do the things that we love. And you mentioned the distancing and queues and things like that. And, you know, it's all well and good for theatres or for large, you know, places that can try and, you know, figure out ways. But like you say, often these things are volunteers who are turning up, you know, an hour or two before you are, and they're suddenly having to, you know, get their head around rules. You know, they want to keep people safe. They feel that responsibility as well. So it's not just the rules. It's also, you know, wanting to do the right thing, but with very little training, with sketchy guidance in a lot of ways, but also with the knowledge that, well, if we don't get this right, then they might take it away again.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it that brought with it dark comedy. I think there, when you were talking of at the turnstiles at Lancaster, where this brilliant volunteer steward woman just kept banging the temperature gun against her leg because it wasn't working, and just went to me, I think they got these in Poundland, bloody things. Just doing the very, very best. And, you know, even already by then we were saying, I don't think temperature's got anything to do with it, because everything was just changing all the time. And so it was a brilliant, it's these different things to write about that just added to the colour of it, I suppose, the difference of it. And then it allowed me to go back into some historical stories. So I wrote about Shankly's time at Workington, which I loved researching that, because I knew nothing about what an effect it had on him living there and his almost filmic relationship with Billy Watson, the kit man, physio, groundsman, and all of the rest, which I could see working, as a sort of piece of theatre. And so, and looking back at Middlesbrough, my own teams, and the town's relationship with Don Revie. So there's history in there as well. I love to try and eke that out of these places.
Did you miss football more than you thought you were? But none of us sort of knew it was coming. So that's probably not the best way to phrase the question. But were you surprised how much you missed it? Because, you know, with your life, the sort of the way it is, you can go, you know, a couple of months, you know, without seeing your team, Middlesbrough, because you live up in Scotland. But you'll always, you know, you'd always be trying to sort of go to games. And then football's obviously, you know, ever present. So. Yeah. Do you think it was the fact that you couldn't if you wanted to, or do you think it was, did you just generally, you know, kind of have this feeling of loss much more than you were maybe expecting?
I think so. I think there was almost a feeling of novelty at the start, and because everything was, if you listen again to news reports, which I did for this, and they're quite chilling now, it was sort of, it'd be back on in 3 weeks, it'd be back on April or so, and it just kept, so you never really...
It's like the First World War, isn't it? We'll all be back for Christmas.
Again and again and again, because I'm a very optimistic person, I would believe them quite often, and I would think, well, I'll get to cover the whole country for this book, because I knew I was doing it by then, I had my book deal and things, and so... I think it was that, more than anything, it was that withdrawal of choice, of liberty almost, to just go off to any old game. And it must have been bad because it made me get a Borough season ticket for the first time in 5 years so that I knew I'd be there when it came back. So that's how drastic it was.
Well, as a man who on our prediction show in the summer tipped Chris Wilder's Middlesbrough to win the championship, I've got sort of feeling for you as well. You mentioned all these grounds you sort of go to, and you're up and down the country, and you've done it before. You know, your previous books, like Hatters and Railway Man and things like that, is similarly travelled and looks at community. You know, when people say things like, oh, you know, oh, football means everything to people from sort of this place, is it just everywhere? And we just think we're special.
I think we probably do as Northerners or as Scousers or as not, you know, Northeast, the hotbed of soccer, but not the hotbed of trophies. And possibly, although I never got further south than thinking about it now, Southport. maybe I can't think what's
a world, a worldwide tour of the Northern Rail.
Yeah, I can confirm that in the coal fields, the coal seam that goes from Lanarkshire down to Merseyside, that we do think I think they are universal values, aren't they? I think if we understood foreign languages better, we'd find the same everywhere. And that, to me, is the beauty of it, thinking it's your thing and it matters more to you. That's a lovely thing. That's how you feel about family, and so you should feel it about football.
Absolutely. But we did, you know, I guess, all reevaluate what football meant to us and what also football means to communities and for Liverpool, you know, even when they opened grounds back up, but they didn't necessarily open up cities back up, I realised how much we missed people coming. People, outsiders, you know, add a vibrancy to a place, and, you know, Liverpool's a worldwide fan base, and so we're reasonably sort of unique in that, in footballing terms. But yeah. I think for all of us, really, just people coming from even other towns, you know, depending on what sort of league you're in, and coming to, you know, enjoy football, you know, does add something to a place.
Yeah, absolutely. Enriches, and it enriches the stations on a match day when you pass other fans from other teams and all of that. And flipping it the other way around, I just missed getting on a train and sort of hearing someone say goodbye in one accent and hello in a completely different accent, and the many names for bread rolls across the country. That kind of thing, that felt... That restriction of liberty really hit me hard, and as it did so many, because I just love to be moving around and going to different places and seeing not just the football, but to see different towns. So I think that definitely worked both ways.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, when I'm reading it and when I was reading the book, I was, you know, just sort of reminded of something, and it's something that Neil talks about a lot, is the importance of football clubs, you know, within communities and these civic institutions, really, and their power to bring people together. And I know football grounds don't feel like they're welcoming to everyone at some points, but they should. And football clubs, you know, are doing more and more, you know, up and down the country to make sure that they are inclusive, make sure that they are welcoming to sort of, you know, everyone within society, because it is important we've all got somewhere to go, and it's important we've all got somewhere to celebrate, you know, our towns, our cities, our communities, you know, what brings us together. And that's what football grounds are. And, you know, I sort of really got that from your book as a reminder of that, really, that the football is, it's the early quotes in the book, isn't it? The most important of the least important things.
Yeah, and especially in some of the post-industrial towns, I've often found when I've written about them that the club's one of the only things people know the town for now, and that enhances that sense of what an important place the ground is to the town itself as well. And absolutely in this time, I think, And clubs were brilliant during COVID, if you think back to the stuff that they were doing with food banks. And, you know, I think near me in Scotland, Stenhouse Muir had a library in the ground, and they took books out to people who didn't have any. Just little things like that are what a football club can do. And we saw that during COVID. And I thought that was worth mentioning and recording as well, that they do just such brilliant things. And it's not the most celebrated or talked about side of football, but that's why another reason we love them.
Do you enjoy it? Do you enjoy doing it? Do you enjoy the process of writing it all up?
I mean, no writer really enjoys writing. I don't believe anyone that says they do, but I enjoy getting the finished product. I absolutely enjoy the visits and taking notes and writing down little things that people say and being a nosy parker like that, because there's such good dialogue to be overheard on public transport and elsewhere on these trips. So I love the trips themselves and researching the places, and then the sheer hell of writing eventually passes by and the book comes out.
It is The Silence of the Stands by Daniel Gray. It is out now from the good people at Bloomsbury. A fantastic Christmas present, I think, Dan. Do you not agree?
I totally agree, John. Yes.
For anyone, I think anyone would enjoy it, football fan or not.
I mean, I've got a few friends that don't like football that are reading and enjoying it. No good for this podcast to pitch it that way, but buy yourself one if you like football, and then buy your non-footballing relative one as well.
It is very important to buy yourself a present this Christmas if you can't afford it. Dan, lovely to speak to you. Best of luck with it. I'm sure it'll do really well.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me on again.
Author of Reffing Hell on the wonderful Halcyon Publishing is Ian Plenderleith. I first came across Ian's work when he pulled together a book of short stories, football fiction, called For Whom the Ball Rolls. There are bookshelves in the Anfield Rap offices, and if you're ever around and you want to treat us as a library, about 20 years ago, For Whom the Ball Rolls came out, put together by Ian. It is a pretty wonderful book, that one. And he's written a couple since, and his most recent one is called Reffing Hell, which is the stories of him refereeing football matches around Frankfurt. And Ian, I mean, firstly, what a life, what a story. I want to ask one question. What's it like refereeing in your second language?
That's not one of my main problems, because I speak German fairly fluently. So especially,
you can understand exactly how people are being rude to you.
Oh, exactly, yeah. And I'm involved with football on several levels as a journalist and as a coach as well. The whole vocabulary of football is very familiar to me. So it doesn't really feel like I'm refereeing in a second language. It's very much my primary language when it comes to football. So that's definitely the least of my problems out there on the pitch.
It strikes me there's a constant interaction. I like the fact that you mentioned in one of the chapters, you mentioned the idea of the best moments of refereeing is an advantage that leads to a goal. That, you know, that's the moment where you feel most vindicated. You make the point that nobody ever says thank you, but that is the moment there where you feel as though, you know, you've sort of read through. And I think it sort of reminded me when I read that bit of the extent to which referees really are active participants within games, certainly if they're doing it right, that there is this sort of, when you're trying to get a feel for a game, you've got to have that sense, haven't you, as to whether or not there is likely to be an opportunity that stems from this period of play. And you can only do that by being in the midst, in the middle of the match.
Yeah, you don't want to be too big an influence on the game. The cliche about the best referees being the ones that you don't notice is certainly true. And there are a lot of games where I'm very happy that I'm taking a backseat role. But I just refereed a game on Sunday in a small village way outside of Frankfurt, and I was very much the center of attention from both teams and both sets of fans for the full 90 minutes. And it's absolutely exhausting. And you come out off the field, you're just happy. It was a nil-nil game. It was one of those games I was sure there was going to be like a a controversial penalty call in the 93rd minute. Thankfully, there wasn't, but there were plenty of questions and commentaries, and you just want to get out of there at the end of it, and you kind of, you know, you're not sure if you really were at fault for everything. Was it just like two particularly dirty and unsporting teams, or did you just have a bad day? So yeah, it's really a question of you know, how much you like being the center of attention. Obviously, if you've had a good game and everybody's offering you handshakes and compliments at the end, you come away feeling like it's all been worthwhile. All too often, though, I cycle home just seriously wondering how much longer I can do this and what I'm really getting out of it.
Well, you mentioned that, and you in one of the chapters you talk to a younger referee who, you know, is a 13-year-old who's been refereeing, and he ends up sort of saying, I'm on the verge of just sort of leaving this and letting them crack on. And he references there the coaches, and it's interesting, your manifesto at the end, you mentioned the coaches, especially sort of at youth level. It feels as though that's the area just sort of working through the book. I almost feel as though there's a level, don't get me wrong, but there's a level of sort of emotional interaction with players live. I feel as though you feel you can put up with. And you understand that the fans, when there is a crowd, the crowd's the crowd. It feels mm-hmm. to me as though the bugbear for you, especially refereeing youth levels, is the interactions with the coaches.
Yeah, the coaches are absolutely key. You can tell straight away if a youth team has a good coach by the way that they interact with you. If a coach is dancing up and down on the touchline yelling at you, that has an immediate effect on their players, and they will start to mimic their coach in terms of their attitude and their approach to fouls, to sport in general. And one of the things I mentioned in the manifesto is that the need for a basic qualification for all coaches so that they have a kind of an official license. It doesn't have to be anything to do with actually knowing how to coach football, but more to do with how to manage teams and how to manage referees and to make the sporting arena a good place for young people to learn how to play sport and to learn how to play on a team. And I think we're missing that in youth football in a lot of countries. I hear very similar stories from England, Ireland, from the United States, where I used to referee as well. And it all goes down to the influence of the mentor and the person who's in charge of young players. And that's the role of the coach, you're right, is absolutely crucial to fostering a culture of better conduct in the future for football.
There's something where, as part of that, one of the things that strikes me, you know, when we play games, all games, you know what I mean? You're dealing with someone whose earliest memory is overturning Hungry Hungry Hippos at the age of five, that when we play all games, we can be, you know, carried away and grabbed in the moment. It seems to me as though at that youth level, you obviously, you know, you can't play a game without wanting to win. But you know, to sort of separate that from where we end up seeing, you know, for want of a better phrase for it, senior football. It seems to me as though the sides that, certainly the ones that you have the better relationship with, but also the ones that aren't ending their participation in a league halfway through the season, which you detail within the book as well, they're mm-hmm. the ones who are able to play for the enjoyment of it and find the winning within there and also find the development. And it strikes me that that's something that has sort of been lost from lots of bits of football, and it saddens me, the thought that, you know, it's not an English issue, that it's the case in Germany as well, that idea of playing because you want to play, you obviously want to win, but because you want to play, I feel is something that the sport needs, I think, to a massive extent at all levels. I would stress, you know, you've got to fulfill fixtures. We've all got to play 38 games a season in the Premier League, for instance. You know, at some point there will be 9th versus 11th with 3 games to go. You've got to be able to find things in this that aren't just the idea of overall triumph or utter disaster.
Yeah, I try to emphasize to all the teams that I coach that I don't care about the results as a coach. I just care about their development as players, and that they learn how to interact with each other, with the opponents, with the referee, with the other coaches in a decent and human manner. And you're absolutely right. Of course, everybody wants to win. As a coach, I have my moments on the sideline too, but I do keep them very much internal. But there would be no point in playing the game at all if you didn't want your team to score goals and to win. It's the way that you win those games. Are you a gracious winner? Can you accept defeat? I think those are the most important things to bring home to people in youth soccer, that it's not the end of the world if you've lost a game of football. There will be another one along next week. You'll have a chance to win that one instead. And that you can get so much more out of playing than just looking at the league table and looking at how many points you've got and lording it over the team down the road in the next neighbourhood. You see so much happening on the field which is beyond the bounds of rational behaviour. And I think we all know that as football fans, that's how the game affects us in many ways. But you also see so many scenes where players help each other up, where as soon as the final whistle's blown, that they hug each other and they shake hands, they laugh about something. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes it can be quite the opposite. It can be very nasty, and there's shouting and pushing, and the parents get involved. That's happened many, many times. But I also have to keep a sight of the good moments, that there are plenty of good moments of good sporting behaviour.
Yeah, you cite there's a chapter you do about a nightmarish game. You call it the Moroccan Derby. There's a brother playing on either side. It's towards the end of the book when you're getting closer and closer to the manifesto. And it's interesting because you referee two games that weekend and you end this. You do 13 bullet points about the second game, which was a 5-4 thriller by all accounts. That ends with 12 yellow cards. But the one before was, you know, there was a little bit of dissent early in the game. They get a yellow card and then you just disappear from the game in that one. And it strikes me that's, you know, the idea of firstly, you give up both days of your weekend to do this there, but also that you get such disparity between the two experiences. It must be so strange because, you know, you obviously get to know the sides as you're reffing them through this, and you make that clear within the book. So you're probably sort of, you know, not looking forward to the Sunday in that instance, but it's this really strange, you know, this is the way in which this is going to go, which I think is you know, sometimes you can predict, but sometimes you mustn't be able to at all what it is you're going to end up having to live through in the middle of the pitch.
Yeah, so sometimes you'll talk to somebody at halftime and they'll say, "Oh, very quiet game today." And I always say, "Yeah, they're always the most dangerous ones." So often at halftime, I thought, "Oh, this game's going really well," and I'm probably going to, you know, add a little note to the match report how sporting these two teams were. And then by the end of the 90 minutes, it's all gone pear-shaped and the sky's on fire, so to speak. You just don't know. I mean, you do have a certain amount of influence. The way you manage a game definitely has a huge influence. Like you just said, an early yellow card for dissent or a bad foul and a sharp word from me can really calm the waters. Sometimes, though, whatever I say or do just has no effect, and games seemingly have their own momentum, and they're sometimes, as you said, there's a background. There are certain teams that just have a culture of bad behavior, and they know it too, and the leagues know it too, all the referees know it, and they're serial offenders, and I don't really know what the best thing to do about that is, other than to keep showing up every week and hoping that I can convey my authority in sufficient ways to keep them in check.
Last little thing, Ian. I want to talk about the sort of the order in which you've written this book and when you decided to write it, and also the purpose of writing it, because on all of these chapters as you're going through the sort of 5 years of refereeing, are they all sort of written in the contemporary moment immediately after the game around the time of doing your report? Or have you revisited them in the end and found that? Because it feels to me like you're trying to answer the question as to why you do this. And it's one of the reasons the books are really compelling read, is that you're the lead character and you're trying to work out, why exactly am I doing this all the way through this book? How did you approach that?
You're exactly right. It started out as a blog. And the reason I started the blog was so I could get the games off my chest on Monday morning. Because I felt nobody was writing anything like this about what it really is like to be an amateur referee. I couldn't find anything else on the internet with a similar kind of narrative or similar kind of stories from the perspective of an amateur referee. Secondly, I was getting depressed, to be honest, by refereeing. I was thinking about it way too much. And that's when I decided if I write down what's going through my head while I'm refereeing these games. Maybe I can cope with it better. And it worked really well. I wasn't expecting the blog still to be going almost 7 years later now. But when the idea for the book came up, I did go back and picked the best blog entries and didn't really tinker with any of them, just from the point of view of language, but from the feeling of what this was like on this particular day. There were games in there I'd completely forgotten about, and so I'm glad that I did keep a record. And I love to tell the story. When I was doing an index for the book, I had an entry under L for losing my shit. And if I'd been asked how many times have you lost it on the field as a referee, I would probably have said, oh, you know, maybe once or twice. And there were 9 entries under the L for losing my shit, which kind of alarmed me a little bit because I'm supposed to be the one keeping my composure. But it does reflect a little bit how often even I, who try to be the cool authority of the referee, even I have several times just not been able to keep it in out there. And I've got mad with teams and players and said, you know, you guys are completely off the radar of sportsmanship here. Either, you know, pull yourselves together or I'm going to cancel the game.
There we are. It's a pleasure to read and a reminder that the whole thing doesn't happen without people in the middle of the pitch who have to put up with at times far too much, especially, you know, probably from me at Anfield, although they probably can't hear me much of the time. It's worth bearing in mind, though, every now and again, and especially whilst playing the game, it does matter. And coaching, as was said before, by Ian. It's on Halcyon. Halcyon are a great publisher, and it's noticeable just quickly, Ian, not least because they're not here, and so we don't have to be embarrassed by it. I've been published and edited by Rob and Adam at Halcyon. They're remarkably supportive and good people to work with, aren't they, Ian?
They're brilliant, brilliant publisher. I absolutely love working with them, and it's been a perfect match for my writing and their enthusiasm and knowledge for football. They're great editors to work with.
So if you're looking for a book over Christmas, a book for anyone, I strongly recommend Ref in Hell by Ian Plenderleith. If you're looking for 3 or 4 books, go and check out everything that Halcyon are doing. They are the absolute business. So thank you to Ian. Thank you to Rob and Adam as well for sending this one my way. Thank you to Ian for writing For Whom the Ball Rolls many a year ago, a book that did have a little bit of an impact on me around what you can and can't do when you are talking and writing and thinking about football. Do check out Reffing Hell. Let's crack on with the rest of the show.
And it is John Gibbons for this Tour Live special. And we are joined by your friend and mine, Keo, here not to talk about his music necessarily this time, although obviously it's music inspired. It's a new book he's got out, My First Liverpool Songs, all about inspiring young Reds to love the club even more, but also to join in with the song. So, but Keo, first of all, thanks for coming in.
Welcome. See us. Good to see you.
So how long has this been in the making then, this book?
I've had the idea for a little while, but in the past few months I've really put it into action. It's something I've wanted to do, as I say, for a little while, because to me, Liverpool fans, I want everyone to be a Liverpool fan, and especially I love seeing young kids into the Reds and love seeing young kids singing Liverpool songs. So I think it's a great idea to get people into the involved in the club and in the culture, and so get learning the songs we sing every week.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what you want to do when you're young. I remember being a kid and just wanting to, you know, once I had the book, you know, you want to know it all, don't you? You want to know about everything about the players and everything about the history, but also the songs and the songs that the cops sing and seem to just start all in unison. You're like, I need to know all the words to that. And it's not as easy as you think. Sometimes you're trying to pick things up, but they could be so fast or whatever. And so something like this would really help.
Well, that's the idea. The idea is to be able to read this book, enjoy it, and, you know, learn the words. Like I say, you just hit the nail on the head there. When you're a kid, you're obsessed. I was obsessed when I was a young kid with Liverpool. I wanted everything to do with Liverpool, books, magazines, you know, CD, anything I could get hold of. I feel that, like, you know, kids will love this, and especially not only just the kids, the parents as well who have kids. I mean, like, it's, in my eyes, this is going to replace bedtime stories and lullabies, and you're going to have a firm of kids across the world now singing We Are Liverpool, tra-la-la-la-la, just before they go to sleep.
Well, let's hope so. That'll liven up my kids' bedtime, do you know what I mean? I'd look forward to it and enjoy it more, certainly. You must know from doing the shows, and I know Boss do the kids shows, but even from playing in the Sander and stuff like that, you know, we've got a mutual friend, Sam, who comes to see you every time. Yeah. The Sander, he brings his lad, and I know for him, for his lad, it's as much part of the match day as going to see you and singing the songs than it is going to see Mo Salah play. And, you know, they do love it, the kids, though. They do love everything about the game, but especially, you know, singing about their heroes is huge.
If not more than the adults in the crowd. That's what inspired it. Like I say, I do the match days in the sand and every single match day. And down the front, there's always pockets of fellas or women who've brought the kids along, and they absolutely love it. And just as one song's finished, you know, they can see them waiting for the next one. Some of them are already shouting out Bobby Firmino and stuff like this. So I said that's what inspired it. Seeing people who love Liverpool is one thing, but kids who love Liverpool and getting them involved in the club, that's, if I can inspire kids to go and support our club and, you know, make our atmosphere a better place to be in, then let's do it.
It's not just a songbook, it's beautifully put together as well. And I know, you know, you've got a keen interest in design and things like that, and it's been part of your career as much as sort of music has, really. So it would have been important for you to, you know, not just bring out a little Bible of footy songs, really, but for it to be appealing to young people and as visually appealing as it is.
Yeah, initially that I was thinking down that road of you know, just putting a list of songs together, but there's, I mean, we could probably write them down for your little lad if you wanted to. It's not as appealing as seeing a book which has illustrations of flags and, you know, the ground and all the things that we associate with a match day culture that we take for granted, really. Like seeing the flags and the scarves and you know, the gates outside and all this sort of thing. It's part of our match day routine now. But to a kid, everything's brand new. Everything's amazing. So, and you're right, I've got a passion for design, but not, I have a design. This was designed by my mate of mine, Rob, from Laser Studio. But I wanted it to be visually appealing. I didn't just want lyrics in a book, and I wanted to create something which was a little bit more than that. And that's why there's poems in there. That's why there's a bit of a story in there, which I've written myself, and not just put the lyrics in that we know.
Yeah, it does tell a story sort of all the way through, and a little bit of the story of the songs and stuff like that, which is really nice. And, you know, when you brought it in, I just thought straight away that that's a lovely present. And, you know, it is out for Christmas, and if people buy it now, you know, you're doing your best to get all the orders out for
people. Well, that's it, yeah. We've launched the website yesterday, and the pre-orders have been coming in. We're going to start shipping them tomorrow, and Monday will be the first batches that go out. Doing everything we can to get it in for Christmas. That's why I recommend, if you're going to order it, get it ordered now, because otherwise, if you leave it too late, we're going to be in the mercy of the couriers and the Royal Mail at the minute, which is you know, a situation which we can't really control. So get it in, get the order in now, and I'll get it out to you as fast as possible in time for Christmas. It's a perfect little stocking filler.
Yeah, the website is
myfirstliverpoolsongs.com.
Myfirstliverpoolsongs.com, and if people want to buy it. And must be really pleased with the reaction. Like you said, you've only launched it this week. It was a bit sort of a bit of a secret thing. I'm sure a few people close to you knew about it, but I certainly didn't until it was out there. And I was buzzing off seeing so many people like all around the world going, oh, I love it. Can I get hold of it?
That's it. I was a bit nervous because, as you know, I'm not like the nervous person.
Always cool and collected.
Yeah, not even that. I'm only loud in everyone's faces, but I was a little bit nervous because, you know, this is something a bit outside my box, and like, I've never written a book before, and I didn't know that the reaction was going to be like, but I genuinely am overwhelmed with it. Like, I've seen orders come in from America, from Belgium, from all these places around the world, and like, as you know, doing what you do, we have a massive following, fan base at this club. And we do have reach all over the world. So it's not just people in Liverpool that are going to be learning these songs. It's going to be people in America and people in Denmark and people in Norway that are going to be learning these songs. So I'm made up, mate. I really am. Like, I'm overwhelmed with it.
And people like me, he's got a little boy and a little girl. And Craig, any father, we do want to brainwash these children, don't we?
That's the idea. That's the idea. Before anyone else has a chance to get, there's a culture growing now around YouTube and preferring players over clubs. No, I'm not into that. I'm into learning the songs the old fashioned way. And we are Liverpool, tra la 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 la. So he's going to replace bedtime stories for me now.
And that's the thing, is it? Because you talked a bit about young. A lot of kids are now into players and stuff like that, but you know, which I get, like why you'd watch YouTube and buzz off like Messi and Mbappe and all of that, but there is nothing like supporting your own team, is there? And me and you've been lucky to have, you know, some fantastic times traveling the world watching this football club. But one day it's going to be someone else's go in the new generation, and to start their love affair and to help start their love affair with this fantastic club, because, you know, I'm biased, we're biased, but I think it is the most fun football team to support. Yeah, and this is all part, the songs are all part of it.
Definitely. Like, and as you said there, it's we've had some great days watching Liverpool. And if I can inspire one kid to get him to, you know, to buy into the bug that we call it, don't we? When you get the bug and you become obsessed with Liverpool, if I can inspire one kid to start supporting this club and start singing these songs, then the book's done its job, because that's the idea, to inspire the next generation of Liverpool fans to become obsessed like we are, and
yeah,
to go in at the deep end and have a journey over the next 20 years, 30 years, 40 years of their life, going around the world and watching Liverpool win trophies.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? Well, we've got you in here. I presume you're not hanging up the guitar to him.
No,
fully focus on him, written stuff. So, you know, how do you reflect on last year? How do you, you know, what are you looking forward to next year and all of that?
I've had an amazing year with Liverpool. There's been ups and downs, of course, but personally, be able to go and play to new places, to new people. That's why what I love most about what I do. And to be going to Norway and Spain and, you know, Paris, playing to an absolute sea of people. So I draw a line in the sand in that day before things went a little bit different. But to play to that amount of people and to be a fan of Liverpool and to be able to sing along with 90, 70,000 people, whatever it was in front of you, That's unbelievable. So this year's been great for me, and I hope next year just brings more of that and more trophies for the Reds as well.
Well, best of luck with the music, and obviously best of luck with the book. Just a reminder, that website to get it. People want to get it. We encourage them to be quick, like you say. But yeah, if people do want to buy it, how do they do it?
MyFirstLiverpoolSongs.com.
And on social media. And
social media. Just all my social, the link's in there. Keogh Music, you can buy it from there. And yeah, support it, share it, and I appreciate everybody that's buying into it.
Well, as I say, it looks beautiful. It's a fantastic idea. Well in for doing it, because I know a lot of kids are going to get a lot from it. A lot of parents like me as well. But hopefully, yeah, when, you know, a kid gets to go to a cup game or something next year, you know, and they're walking in.
They're well rehearsed,
exactly. They know all the words. They're ready to go.
They might be starting the songs. That's the aim. But thank you, Gibble.
Yeah, all right, Tom, man, thanks for coming in.
Cheers, Gibble.
Joined by Daniel G, who we've had on before, talking about sports law, his excellent book, Done Deal. And he's written a new book, which is called Build the Invisible, Practical Ideas for Achieving Your Dream Career. And when he told me about this, I thought, I very much want to interview Daniel about this. And the reason why is because a lot of people think, for instance, that I and people at Saturday Anfield Rap have something of a dream career. And there's days where it doesn't always feel like that, but there are days where we have to acknowledge it's an absolute pleasure and a privilege to get to do this. And Daniel's book is about him feeling as though he managed to get to where he got to and how it works. And there's a really important bit early in the book, Daniel, I mean, you can disagree if you want, where you say there is no magic formula, but this is good news. And I think that that's a really important thing to come. I think a lot of people sort of, in lots of ways, almost wish there was a magic formula, almost wish there was just one thing that if you could work out how to do it and press a button, everything would be different. And this book is very much about that there is no magic formula, that you have to change lots of small things and then hope that opportunity comes your way. And it just struck me as a really important point, this. There is no magic formula, but that is good news, not bad.
No, thanks, Neil. And but this is actually this is Anfield Rap exclusive, basically. This is the first time I'm actually speaking about the book. So you've got
really excellent.
So firstly, thanks for having me on. And look, it's great that you feel comfortable to talk about other stuff apart from footy sometimes, which is great. But the truth is that, like, we've had loads of conversations around exactly that, which is, on the surface and externally, people see this whole thing, which is, oh, Neil's doing the thing that you know everyone wants to do, which is talk about Liverpool. Daniel's doing the cool transfer and he's, you know, working with loads of cool players, and that's exactly what I want to do. But what they don't see, and maybe we can have this conversation again between the two of us now, which is, they don't see, I won't swear, but all the difficult stuff that goes on in between. They don't see what happened in order to start the Anfield Rap and all of the intricacies and the boring and the monotony of all the other stuff that happens. And they didn't see in the same way. I do a story in the book about how, you know, for 10 years, I wasn't a football lawyer. I wasn't even a sports lawyer. I was an agriculture, auto parts and financial services lawyer, which definitely doesn't sound as interesting as a football lawyer. And the whole point about the book, as you said, is actually to try and give people a little bit of encouragement sometimes that firstly, it's not going to be easy or straightforward.
Yeah.
But like I think everyone goes, same to you, I'm sure, Dan, just tell me the magic formula and I'll just copy it. And the truth is that what I try to do with the book is to almost turn it on its head and say, well, that doesn't work. But what does work are these quite specific practical steps to get you to where you want to get to.
It's what you mentioned there about being an agricultural lawyer, and people often sort of say to me, what did you do before you did this? And I produced a feature film on the one hand, but I did a lot of other jobs and ended up spending a few years in shipping. And one of the things that I always try to sort of make a point I sort of try to make to people is the shipping stuff has been as useful, if not more useful, than the producing the feature film stuff. So you mentioned there being an agriculture lawyer. And I think that there's, again, people, you know, may think there's a new dawn, there's a new day, and then you're a new person. But you're actually, you know, one of the things that I think really matters and helps is being able to take all of your experiences and being able to work out what experiences you need for certain, but being able to take all of your experiences and understand why these are transferable skills. And for me, transferable skills is something which, no matter what age people are, I think it's something that firstly people sort of overlook the opportunity of transferable skills and then honing transferable skills as well. And that comes up repeatedly within the book.
Well, the thing that is probably my biggest takeaway that I learned from loads of people when I was speaking to them as well, which was basically there's a massive part which patience plays in all of this. And there's also a massive part which is things don't have to happen in the short term for them to happen in the long term. So exactly to your point, like I was reading agriculture and vegetable regulations. I was reading car park cases. I was working on shipping cases, Neil, as well, in truth. So we're not too far aligned all in truth. But the thing that got me looking back in hindsight was all of those skills, if it was dealing with difficult clients, writing an important email, responding quickly, working hard, getting in late, getting in early and leaving late. And all of those types of, building blocks stood me in really good stead. And the other thing as well, which I think, you know, it's difficult to say to younger generations or other, it would have been very difficult for me to say to myself 10, 15 years ago, is sort of patience is the key, because you don't have to be in your ideal job in the short to medium term to work out how to get there in the longer term. And for me, that's definitely been the case doing all of this other types of law in order to get me to where I want to. So I give just a brief example in the book, which is like, well, you want to become the best football marketing or football comms expert in the world. You don't need to start in football. You certainly don't need to start in sport. Be the best marketing person you can be. Go and do campaigns and work with all the top people of brands across Europe, across the world. And then make the industry, which is football or sport, want you more than you need the industry. And I think that was almost important thing is like you will then show by your skills and experience the stuff that you can ultimately do.
As part of that, I think there's a really interesting phrase that you use. You mentioned it's used by a woman called Sam Miller around opportunity chains.
Mm.
And that is something which I think is, you know, again, for people, it's brilliantly sort of framed within the book. You end up sort of talking about Thomas Cronemark as well in the same section. But the idea of that ultimately opportunities splinter and you have to sort of follow at times some that you may not entirely be 100% if you'd want to follow to end up in places that you might want to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book where it's, you know, it's obviously sort of about people and the way in which they view their careers. But to me, it's also you very much sort of it's about how people can want and change the nature of who they are. And by doing small, incremental, but consistent steps can make those changes. And part of that is, for instance, finding ways to be more open, more into the idea of saying yes to things, because you never know where a series of yeses might lead. And I think it's a fascinating phrase, opportunity chains.
No, thanks, Neil. And it's actually funny to do an interview. And obviously, this is novel for the first time with someone repeating back the things that I've said for so long. But yeah, if we take that opportunity change point, look, I think everybody sometimes, myself included, thinks in very straight lines, don't we? It's like, if we do this, then this will happen. And if we do this, then the next thing in the chain will happen. Whereas what I was trying to have conversations with people around is sometimes you don't know what's beyond the corner. You don't know what's beyond the choice that you don't understand. You know, it's almost like Matrix stuff, isn't it, really? It's like you don't necessarily know what will happen if a conversation happens and how that splinters into loads of different ways. And so my view on all of that was almost like, put yourself in the position to create the maximum amount of opportunities in every situation. And you do that by just generally speaking to a lot of people. And I give quite a lot of ideas and ways about how to do that. But if you can do that, what then ends up happening is, let's just say you want to be in fashion or music or TV or film or football, for example, or sport. The side hustle is going to be your knowledge. You're always going to be reading the footy news. You're always going to be trying to understand what's going on with the financials. You're always going to be understanding, you know, what's going on with ownership issues. That was like the point of done deal in a way. That was my sort of knowledge side hustle. But when you mix your knowledge side hustle with that opportunity framework, with that, like, right, who am I going to meet? Who can I speak to? Who can I say interesting things to? Who's going to say interesting things to me? Those things, as I said, just create that big opportunity wave. And then you don't just go in one direction, but you go in 150 directions at the same time.
Within that, it's interesting you talk about, when you talk about writing Done Deal, and you talk about how, you know, your wife Holly was important in amongst all of there. One of the ways in which, and I always sort of come back to this, not just from a question around writing, but in lots of things that you can do, is you talk about the fact that you broke it down. So it wasn't, you never had the anxiety of, I've got, I don't know, 50,000 more words to write or something like that. Instead, you had, right, we've got these things to do, and they're achievable in these small steps. And you allotted the time. And again, you know, around that, around writing this book, I'm sure you probably did something very similar indeed. But that isn't just sort of applicable in the writing world. It's applicable sort of full stop, is to find ways to effectively create bite-size sorts of developments rather than the idea of development as a massive whole.
Yeah, exactly right. And I got this idea from, I completely plagiarized from a few different people, but there was this guy called BJ Fogg who did a brilliant TED talk that I listened to a while back, and I actually wrote about it in the book. And he basically said that he wanted to, become fitter and get on more muscle mass, and to actually just improve the way he looked and the way he felt. And he tried everything from, you know, new gym memberships and blah, blah, blah. And everyone starts off well, but then it just deteriorates horribly, like us humans are, because what we're really good at is being inspired, but we're really terrible at consistency. So you have short bursts of intense inspiration mixed with then very poor levels of consistency as a result. And so what he basically said is that if you attach something that you already do to that new habit, and then you basically hook it on, you've got a much better chance of doing it. And the example he gave, which is a really odd one, but actually sort of sticks really well, is he said every time he went to the toilet, he would then do 2 push-ups after he flushed the chain every time. So if you compound that over a long period of time, that's obviously a lot of push-ups or sit-ups or whatever else he wanted to do. But the benefit was is that then after a while, the routine becomes ingrained to the thing that you already do. So, for example, it's like when I have my first cup of coffee for the day, I'm going to read the 2 newspaper articles that I want to do. Or before I have breakfast every day, I'm going to go and put my trainers out and go for a run. So it's just those tiny, tiny, small things. And there's a couple of brilliant books that I quote in the book as well, in my book. But the basic presumption really is that you just do boring, consistent things over a long period of time. And that's like, it sounds terrible to say, but that's definitely not going to be the soundbite for the book. but that's the truth, isn't it? It's like, you know it as well, Neil, as much as I. It's like, how do you get up every day and do the thing when no one else is looking, when no one else is caring, that in 10 years will make a difference for you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm having to cover bits and pieces of Craig Hannon's work at the time we're recording this. And I've actually just got a list of things that I need to just make sure I do before I do anything else over the course of the day, because it's stuff it's not familiar to me, but I need to just sort of check in on this stuff that Craig's asked me to check in on. So I just need to do them before I do anything else. And then I can move on and do other bits and pieces. And I've been doing that all week. And I think I actually might have almost part got the idea from when I was reading the book to prepare for this conversation. I just thought, right, make sure you've got that written, and then you'll be able to go and you'll then have done the things that Craig needs you to do, and then you can get on with your stuff. And that's all in there. Listen, the book is called Build the Invisible, Practical Ideas for Achieving Your Dream Career. Really good to speak to Dan about it. What triggered it in the first place, before I ask you where people can get it from? You were doing some YouTube tutorials during the pandemic. Is that right?
Yeah, literally it started at lockdown where, literally everybody was in, weren't we? I mean, it feels like an age ago now, but, you know, from March or April, like, you're allowed to be outside for half an hour of the day for whatever, 2 or 3 months. And so, you know, I was busy with work, but then at 6 o'clock every day, I just had this idea of like for a month or two, just like do a course on the footy industry or do a course about developing your career. So it started there and it got really nice traction that loads of people tuned in to listen to me, which I found quite odd in the first place. And then it was like, can I do anything with all of these transcripts? And so I started thinking, oh, I could just put the transcripts and publish them basically. But then sort of 2 years later, it's taken a little while. And to be fair, that's the journey that it takes, isn't it, for everyone? It's like, yep, you learn about yourself in the journey and the prep and the routine and the doing and what doesn't work and then what does. And then you iterate again, and then you hope people don't think it's rubbish.
There we are. It isn't. It's called Build the Invisible, Practical Ideas for Achieving Your Dream Career. Where should people get it from, Daniel?
So it's hopefully about to be launched on Amazon in the next couple of weeks, but the print books are going to be there for January and ebooks, hopefully just before Christmas time.
Marvellous stuff. We will link to it, and Daniel himself will push it. And where can people find you on social, Daniel?
So on Twitter, I am Football Law. So that's the stuff I do on a day-to-day basis, which is talking about footy stuff. And yeah, hope we can chat again soon. And then on all the other channels, it's just on Instagram or LinkedIn. I'm actually on TikTok as well, Neil, although I'm not dancing or singing, you'll be pleased to know.
I'm quite the opposite. I would encourage the dancing and singing. Check out Build the Invisible. You'll dance one step at a time, Daniel. That's the way in which it works. Practical ideas for achieving your dream career. Do have a good long look at it.
I'm with Tony Evans to talk about his book, his fiction book, Good Guys Lost. First time Tony's delved in to the realm of fiction. And I think you've drawn on some of your own experiences, but I think it's important that we don't lose the idea that you are simultaneously also writing and creating and constructing a story here, Tony. You know, this is very much, you know, you are in a fiction-based space. You know this world that you're talking about as it moves through the 60s, the 70s and into the 80s. You grew up in it, but simultaneously, you know, this is a strong piece of fiction, a strong piece of storytelling. You are taking this story away from yourself as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, experience given significance equals fiction in, you know, a lot of ways. And yeah, it will be difficult for some people who read it to divorce, particularly the narrator from me. But it's not me. It's not me. It can't be me. There are elements of, you know, my character and my experience of using it. But certainly, I'd like to think I'm a bit nicer than the narrator. I'd like to think I'm a bit less, you know, people can decide that, whatever. Anyway, but like, it was an attempt to look at the experience of not just me, but of the city in the period that I grew up. I mean, you know, my actual first memory is me auntie singing All My Lovin' to me. So my whole experience was Liverpool from the Beatles, and then through the 70s and the contraction of the city, the 80s, you know, the Thatcher wars, for want of a better phrase, and then the 90s and moving on. And it's about the, you know, I was part of that generation that knew they had to leave the place because there were no jobs. You know, I went and lived in the States, so tried to get a bit of that in, and I tried to get the, well, part of me fucking hates this book. Because what it does, it accentuates in many ways some of the worst aspects of the backgrounds and the culture I grew up in. You know, there's two murders, there's there are many unpleasant things happening. And it's not just unpleasant things from people from my background, people from other backgrounds. I think it's got like one of the most evil female villains I could have created. And she's not from the background that I'm from. But what I tried to do is get a sense of how destructive that the politics of self have been on not just Liverpool, not just British society, and not just me.
Well, so within that, the title is Good Guys Lost. And one of the things, as I was reading through it, as it opens, there's a level of bleakness in amongst the story. And the story, you know, it remains bleak, but seeing the essence of that story, I think that what you're trying to put over repeatedly there is that there's the vast majority of people are good who end up trapped in situations and at times not reacting the way in which they should, and then therefore becoming, in inverted commas, bad. That they're framed and that it's surrounded by them. And that's what the Good Guys Lost a little bit of it, you know, in the title means. And that's that's one of the things that I, as I say, at first I was sort of shocked, a little bit taken aback, really, not least because of knowing you, as to how sort of bleak I was finding aspects of it. And then I was like, no, there's the point of this is that you're trying to root these characters as essence of humanity into these situations that they're dropped in as they react.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it can be bleak, and I don't want to give too much away, but I mean, probably the bleakest character is the narrator. And I think by the end of it, by most people's standards, they look at the narrator and think, oh, he did that, right? You know, one of them. It was fucking bleak, let's be honest.
No, then this matters. Yeah. I think this is an important thing, that it's not romanticised at all. That's not what you put over here, and that's not what's within the book at all. There's not a romanticised version of Liverpool in this period. Far, far from it, you know what I mean? And that, I understand why you've got a couple of concerns about that, but I'm reading it going, this is not, we're all having a lovely time as we skip to and from the docks. This is it's very, very, very intensely gritty in there as well. Not even a cliched version of gritty, just this is the way it was for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's raw. I mean, we were poor, for God's sake. You know, so it wasn't great. You know, it's not Benny. You know, it's like, and the other thing, one of the reasons I wrote it is, I think one of the areas where Liverpool culturally has lagged behind other cities is in literature. I don't think Liverpool's produced a great novel. Now, I'm not saying this is the great Liverpool novel, not at all. But it's probably a bit closer than most, you know, one of them. And I think it'd be lovely to see, music. Come on, you bastards, we'll take you on. Football, yeah, we'll take you on. And working class culture would beat the crap out of people. But our working class novels, the ones that I've read, tend to be a little bit sentimental and a little bit, you know, it's
la-di-da.
Yeah, a little bit Ferry Cross the Mersey. Yeah. And you know what? I'm sick of middle class literature. I'm sick of books getting published. That, like, you know, it's I wanted to project the rawness. I just sat down and wrote what I thought was a realistic view of the experience of many people like me. And yes, that includes unpleasant stuff, that includes violence, that includes morals that you might find offensive. You know, like round us, no one cared, but you know, as long as you didn't rob from someone who couldn't afford it, they didn't care. You know, the lads who were professional shoplifters round us, and they come round, they knew what size shoes and trousers I wore, go and knock on the door. I wasn't in, my mother had opened, she got some stuff for you. I told her, she'd just buy it. And you know, and my mother went to church, was in her mind an extremely moral person and better than most. Same with my aunties, you know, really sort of Catholic, God-fearing, if it's a phrase you like to use. But, you know, they had no compunction about buying stolen property. Yeah. And they were outside the margins of mainstream British life. And that's what I'm writing about, people outside the margins of mainstream British life.
That is, it comes through all the way in it. The... What could be the lead character, Billy, whether that's the narrator, whether that's Billy's, you know, it's an interesting way in which the story's structured in amongst there. Billy, obviously, you know, commits all but murder, horrendous assault early in the book, pays the price for that, and then sort of moves himself along. What's interesting is, in terms of the good guys lost, it's as much about sort of a loss of innocence. Billy's remarkably simultaneously unlucky. That's not to say the same thing as the way in which he reacts to that bad luck is pleasant, but he's remarkably unlucky and lucky in the way in which a couple of things happen. And then within that as well, in the music career aspect, unlucky there as well, and you've got the songs to detail that too.
Interestingly enough, the actual title Good Guys Lost comes from a Leonard Cohen song. Leonard Cohen, yeah, right. I hate Leonard Cohen. I don't actually hate it.
You don't hate Leonard Cohen?
No, I don't hate. No one hates Leonard Cohen, but he's not my go-to. Listen, but it's the song from line from Everybody Knows. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost, and the whole thing from the first page of the book, or the first section of the book, I talk about the character is aware. Becomes aware that he's been involved in this great war, and that's the war that poverty conscripts you into, you know, the Great War against patronage, the Great War against conservatism. He talks about patronage and the way it's changed, because once we move into the political section, it becomes clear, because it's very, very political move. But they're involved in this war, and sometimes it's with themselves.
Yeah.
But mostly, you know what? The odds are stacked against you when you're born into poverty, and you're born, you know, I used to like laugh and joke in the States, you know, like when I was working on the building sites. I say I was born for manual labour and war, and that's what we were born for, and that's what all the expects of us. And it's about people trying to rise above their expectations, but being constrained by the society they live in.
Within that, you've got you're going to release or find a way to release some songs that go with the lead character. Billy is a guitarist, is a performer. I think that matters, but then also works at the graft of it. I really enjoyed that little bit in there as well, where it's referred to him deciding he's going to have to work on these songs like he's carrying a load of bricks, a hod of bricks up the ladder. The idea that he understands that there's actually it's not some sort of artsy nonsense that it becomes. The job of work is to make the songs work, and the making the songs work will be graft, and he grafts through. But you've actually got some songs that you're going to be able to release alongside it from bands you played in when you were growing up.
Yeah, it's me and my cousin collaborated on some songs in the 80s, you know, so at the same time I was in the farm, and he was very talented. But again, like so many from our background, had a combination of self-destruction and the inability to see a coherent way out of the life.
Do you think, just on that, do you think it's self-destruction, or do you think it's the sort of levels of personal... I'm all right with destruction, but more that if you're from a certain background, it's harder to rebuild. If you know what I mean, like I refuse to believe for a second that there's not the same sort of streaks in other stratas of society, that they don't exist elsewhere, but that it's a much softer landing to rebuild your life after those sorts of points.
Yeah, you're 100% right, Neil. You know what? It's the problem. It's like you don't get second chances when you're from our background. You don't get leeway. So if you do, you've got to be, it's worse, obviously, for black people. You know, we talk about having to work harder, and they get even fewer chances. But, you know, we're down the scale from that, but we still don't get that many chances. So if you screw up, you do something daft, well, you're gone forever.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got the family connections, you got the money, you got wealth, then you can rebuild. So you might be right. It's too hard to say self-destruction, but... But suffice to say, we worked on them and we recorded them and I always thought they were all right. I mean, you know, not stunning, you know, the demos but when I started writing the book, which was not inspired by them, not by any stretch of the imagination, but when I thought I'm writing about a singer songwriter and I've got songs, you know, I can't imagine any other book where you can actually decide whether if this character wouldn't have committed the crimes he commits, whether he would actually have made it. But the reader can listen to it and either go, oh, that's shite, he wouldn't have made it, or go, oh, that's brilliant, he would have. So, you know, it gives the
that's shite, or that's not shite, which is, you know, two ways of looking at things. That's something that one thing I got from the book was sort of, you were very, very matter of fact, very flat, very reportage. You were very much, this is a series of events, and you can like the series of events or you can dislike the series of events, but it's a series of events you're going to have to come with. And to me, that was, it's a really brave sort of literary choice. There's very little floweriness to it. There's a real, you just lay it out over and over again, chapter and subchapter, over and over again, go, do you want this? This is me telling you the way in which it is. And even the more explosive stuff, there's a really good section where lead character sees the jam for the first time and is knocked over by it. And in that as well, there's a real brutality with the language in terms of how we get knocked over by it. It isn't sugar-coated, it isn't sweet, it isn't, you know, this is what it was like to see the jam in 1977. And that was a real choice of yours, wasn't it? Because it's not like you don't know all the words. You wanted to tell it this way.
One of the things about writing, I find, is it doesn't give you too much choice. It's like when you start sitting down, you might want to write in a flowery style. But I kind of think sort of voice takes over for me. And like, well, often when I look back on the stuff I've written, whether it be for papers, whether it be for any other area, I look back and I can't believe it's me. I'm like, no, that's not me. I didn't.
It's almost performative in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like a voice. You get possessed. A voice takes over. I'm for this. I mean, I'm always terse. I think, you know, and I hate people who overwrite. You know, it's like
you do.
I find it very frustrating. And so I'm always terse. I always have been. But like this, you know, in a world where most of the scenes I'm talking about are fairly tense, they're fairly confrontational. It's, you know what, people don't realise today, you know, young people, how confrontational Britain in the 70s and 80s was. And I mean, I saw that when, from, you know, when I did the I did that bit on the Italian 90 documentary, I got bombarded people on Twitter, you know, and in my personal email, like, I was outraged because of saying how much joy I took when Millwall rioted at Luton. And like, and they don't understand the environment we were living where, you know, it's like, you know, the way we were treated by police, the way we were treated by the authorities, the way people were prone to use the fists much more than they are now. It was a much harder world. And so writing about it, you have to reflect that, you know, it's and sometimes people, you know, there's two things going on about certainly the 70s and 80s. You've got those who romanticize it in a brutish way, the hooligan books, which I hate. You know, we were knights of the streets, our firm against their firm, bollocks. It was generally large groups of people bullying the shit out of each other and kicking other people out, you know, all over the place. So, but I wanted to write about it as honestly as I could. Do you know what? There was no point in me writing if I don't write honestly.
Yep.
And so I tried to write as honestly as I could, and you won't fucking like it.
But they should buy it.
Well, I don't. Part of me doesn't care whether you do or not.
Well, they are. Who's the publisher? Because they'll be made up with this turn of events. Who is the publisher?
The publisher, Northodox, is who are committed to producing Northern voices, Northern writers. But, you know, part of me, I don't really. Dear listener, I don't really write for you. I don't really write for anyone. But what I write for is to try and get a truth out there. And I don't think this truth is being put out there by many people. So you know what? Don't buy it. Please yourself. But you'll miss out on something.
You will indeed, Good Guys Lost. You will miss out on something. That is quite the spirit. Get it read, whether you like it or not. Get it read. I think you will like it, though. Podcast Network.